Okay, welcome back. This is lecture 6 of broadband networks. So we had been discussing in the last class the slide set on ISDN, X.25 and so on, frame relay and ATM. Today we'll continue into frame relay and ATM right now. So just I wanted to mention that some of this, the both the textbook unfortunately do not have an extensive coverage of the topics I'm using the slide set. So I have had to take material from other textbooks, but as far as the exam goes, the slide set should be fairly complete. Okay, so just in case you wanted to know about which book I got my some of my information from, so one reasonable book for ATM, can we point at this please? Yeah. Not yet. Okay. Is this book by Ulysses Black on ATM, volume 1. Okay, so the books on ATM, and Stallings has a number of books on high-speed networks and so on, which are reasonable, but sometimes they don't have detail. I mean, this book is fairly detailed on ATM, but in my opinion, it's a very bureaucratic book. Okay, so bureaucratic books are like the C++ language. Okay, so it's a bureaucratic language. Okay, it makes you declare everything, right? So the bureaucratic books like this will... It's a nice book, okay? It has a lot of details, a lot of new nice pictures. But it goes from, just talks about standards without necessarily giving you the insight about why it happened, okay? So anyways, but it gives you lots of details, okay? And hopefully it's a reasonable reference, and just want to mention it. So by the way, for this class, we'll be looking at a lot of references outside the two textbook alone. And if you look at my webpage, I have lots of references listed there. And if you're really interested in that topic, or in particular, if you want to do a term paper in that area, I recommend you go and get hold of the reference either from the library or you want to purchase it and so on. Okay, so so getting back to ISDN, I just put in a couple of slides which talks about the terminology which is used. We can safely skip this. So that's just for completeness. Okay, so the other service of primary of ISDN is known as PRI service, known as primary rate ISDN. If you look at it pictorially, it means that you want to get 1.544 megabit per second and 24 channels, and it's a packetized service. So that's why it's sometimes called 23B plus D service. And it's also carried over a DS1 circuit. So you can actually buy a T1 line from here to your ISP and then run a PRI service from here through the ISP, or you can run it, this is the phone carrier, and then you can run the PRI service a little more further. So you can form a virtual circuit. So in essence, you're buying a smaller T1 line just to get to your central office, but then beyond that, you can use packetized services all the way to get to wherever you want. Okay, so one of the pictures you commonly see in networking is the stack pictures. Okay, so and in the telephony world, they typically call these reference models. Okay, so this looks like a nice pile of bricks here. So you have typically one set of bricks which is called user plane. Okay, or sometimes we call it data plane. Okay, I prefer the word data plane because it refers to all the functions that are done on every packet that comes. And then you have a bunch of bricks here for control plane. Okay, now one might argue, why do you need so many bricks for control plane? But there are so many bricks. Okay, so you see that there's a lot of heavyweight control functions in telephony based protocols. So you have several layers of control functionality also. Now this is in the internet, you don't have so many bricks for control plane. Okay, control plane is also not coupled to the bricks. You're not cemented them together. Okay, so typically you have a much more lighter weight control plane. And you have more control plane functionality only in routers. The end systems do less control plane functionalities. And then there's also another set of bricks for management plane that spans both the control and user here. Okay, again, in the IP world, this is also fairly lightweight. Okay, in fact, if you study the SNMP protocol, it's extremely light. It's as lightweight as it gets. Okay, so very simple management plane. Okay, now that turned out to be a boon and also a bane. Okay, so today in the internet, as internets grow larger and larger, management of such networks are becoming a trouble, and SNMP is sort of a very simple basis for doing it. Okay, so people are trying to do layer other management functions on top of SNMP, but here you have a very heavyweight management and control architecture. So that's what this means. So essentially, all the way till your end system, you put a lot of functionality both in terms of control and management. While all this might be nice for a Sonnet type system, where there's a lot of money at stake and you have people are making money on top of the Sonnet links, whereas it doesn't make so much sense end to end. Okay, people, users don't value it. Okay, so I talked about the D channel in ISDN, and it also uses something like what we saw in X.25, okay, and it's given the fancy name LAPD, okay, just like bearer channel LAPB or balanced, it's this sometimes called LAPD. Okay, so there's nothing very new about it, except the idea that the information which is carried in this, or the payload of this frame, is the signaling information. Okay, and the particular signaling protocol in ISDN is called Q.931. Okay, now this fancy number is interesting because it makes its appearance all the way up to ATM. Okay, so one thing that survived all the way up to ATM is Q.931. It's a bunch of packet messages used for signaling a channel, and ATM, it just became more and more complex. So you added QoS functionalities to Q.931, etc. But Q.931 is a basic signaling protocol, which operates on top of a simple framing protocol like HDLC, and you have some other special address fields and so on. Okay, so you don't have to worry about anything else. So Q.931, we're not going to go in great detail. In fact, my opinion is that you don't really need to know much about it. Q.931 is a fairly heavyweight signaling protocol. That the primary thing you need to know about signaling is that you carry a 20-byte address when you're trying to set up the call, and then once you've done the signaling, you just use labels. Okay, so in terms of, there are several types of message types. You can try to set up different types of channel. You can concatenate it, etc. but we don't need to really understand that. The information fields, information elements which are there, some can set up various types of channels. Okay. Okay, so with that introduction of ISDN, we move on to frame relay. So frame relay can be thought of as a simplified form of X.25. Okay. Now, just to recap, why is frame relay and X.25 interesting? Okay, it's primarily economics. Okay, leased lines are very costly. Okay, and they have nice performance. I mean, you can run telephone lines on them, you can map packets onto them, and they give you guaranteed bandwidth, they give you guaranteed delay. It just looks like a link. Okay, you can't get anything better. Okay, so it's very nice, very predictable, etc. You can monitor it, make sure it's highly synchronized, etc. Okay, but if I want to build a private network, if I'm an enterprise and I want to build a private network, usually it means that I will have to form links. I have to have connectivity across this network. So one way to build a private network is to buy leased lines from every possible site. Okay, now, as you know, this particular topology configuration is known as a full mesh. Okay, and full mesh, we studied in LANs as well, is a very inefficient topology configuration because you have to have lots of links. And I said that it's okay if you have lots of links as long as links are not an economic problem. Okay, whereas in T1, it is an economic problem. Every link is extremely costly. Okay, and the link is costly not only by basis on the size of the link, but also based on the distance the link travels. Okay, and you're having many such links. Okay, so obviously, I mean, people want to get away from this configuration whatever they can. So full mesh means you have to have lots of ports, lots of links, and pay lots of money. Okay, so the what the packet switched public network alternatives provided was something that was not T1. In other words, it was a packet service, and it was a non-guaranteed service that is well differentiated from performance-wise. It's like a best effort service. Okay, and you could reserve to some extent. Okay, in frame relay, we'll see that you can actually reserve some minimum bandwidth, but you cannot reserve delay and all that. Okay, so you cannot control delay because the packet switch network, right? So it's statistical multiplexing. Your delay is convolved with other people's delay and so on. So, but you can still form what are known as virtual channels or virtual circuits from here to here, and you can map whatever traffic you want on that virtual circuit. So at that time when frame relay became popular, that time there were several protocols. There was IP, there was Novell's NetWare was there, there were other SNA traffic, all kinds of. Digital had its own deck, and Apple had Apple Talk. All this stuff, I want to interoperate. I want to have a sort of multi-protocol network. Okay, and frame relay provided this pipe. Okay, I don't care what you're carrying. Okay, just dump it on this frame relay pipe and I'll take you to the other side. By the way, this pipe has a minimum bandwidth, okay, guarantee, and then above that you can burst. Okay, this is known as a burstability, packet-based burstability, burstable service. But then all bets are off, okay, if you burst above that. Okay, and usually all bets are not really off because the packets network is over-provisioned. You can actually send more than the minimum rate. And in fact, many of the circuits used to buy minimum information rate as zero, and then they would just pay some money to be able to burst up to a peak rate. Okay, so this is a beautiful marketing trick, and it worked. Okay, and another major economic factor was that the service guarantees were weaker, but then you removed the distance-based pricing. Instead of paying by the mile, you just pay by the amount of PCR, and I mean that is the peak rate and the minimum rate. So essentially, pricing was indexed based upon the rates rather than the mile. Okay, this turned out to be enormously cheaper. Okay, and for the applications which could tolerate this, like data networking applications, it was great. Okay, and extra 25 and frame relay came to fill in this niche, whereas extra 25 does not provide any sorts of quality of service capabilities. And it's heavyweight. Frame relay is much more lightweight, and it provides a very simple quality of service, which became tremendously popular. Okay, in fact, frame relay is like a $10 billion business or more, just in America. I mean, worldwide, it's much more. By the way, leased lines are even more than that, like $30 billion and more per year. Okay, and of course, all of this has become compressed since the telecom depression. But these are very valuable businesses for the telephone companies. Okay, so it allows you to buy just a leased line through your local exchange carrier to reach the POP of the IXE. And the IXE, from here, you would just get a packet service, right? On top of this packet, you would send either frame relay traffic, okay? And then this fellow would have frame relay switches, which sends this traffic around, and you reach the other side, okay? So that is the basic idea. And then such networks, private networks, which were formed using packets, were called virtual private networks. So not only did you have private networks, you had virtual private networks. See, now virtual means you are actually getting a network on top of some physical resource. So you had a physical network, and then you create this magic network on top called virtual network. And obviously, there's a level of indirection. And many virtual networks share the same facility. In extra 25, the sharing normally means that nobody gets any guarantee. Whereas in frame relay, it means that even though you share, I give you some guarantees. Okay, so that is the key idea. And these pipes you get end-to-end with these guarantees are also transparent to the type of traffic you carry on it. Okay, and these are sometimes known as tunnels. Okay, we learn about it more in MPLS. And the groups of these tunnels where I can form this network is called a closed user group. Okay, now these are standard frame relay terminologies. Okay, so essentially what frame relay allowed you to do was move from full mesh architecture to a hub architecture, where the hub is this entire cloud, right? So we saw the same hub-based or star-based architecture when we studied LAN, right? This is exactly the same thing, but it's only virtual rather than physical, right? Everything clear? Okay, and the trade-offs are that you, instead of getting a layer one digital service and a highly time-synchronized layer one service called T1, you are getting a packetized layer two service, that's frame relay. Or you used to get a packetized layer 3 service, which was X.25. In fact, ATM was also a packetized layer 3 service. Okay, so that is the key difference. And today when you buy IP VPNs or MPLS VPNs, MPLS VPNs are layer 2 services, packetized service. And that's why it's called frame. Frame always refers to layer 2. And in IP, you can get an IP VPN. Okay, and that stands for layer 3, since IP is layer 3, right? Okay, so these are the terminologies, and the service guarantees are certainly weaker. Nothing, all bets are off in terms of delay. Okay, one frame can be delayed, huge amount of time, another frame can be delayed, small amount of time. So not only you don't have fixed delay, you have delay variance, which is called delay jitter. Okay, this is death for telephone. Okay, you can't directly map a telephone call on top of frame relay. Okay, but people became smarter, and they then developed a packet phone service called voice over IP or voice over frame relay. Okay, we'll study all those interesting developments later. And then in that developments, we'll study that you don't really need 64 kilobits per second to do voice. I mean, if you use your cell phone today in GSM, you can do 7 kilobits per second, you can get voice. Okay, so some dramatic advances in terms of voice compression and so on have led to packet voice services, and then some of them have been mapped on top of this. Okay, so we'll study all those voice over these types of things later if you get time. Okay, so the primary difference in frame relay versus XR25 is frame relay is a layer 2 service, XR25 is a layer 3 service. XR25 is heavyweight. It has huge amount of, so if I want to send one message across a link, I will generate 12 messages. Okay, so in economics, if you study, there is something called a multiplier effect. Okay, if the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates and prints money through the banking system, actually more money than it actually printed. Okay, so here, if you send one packet, you get more packets than you actually sent. Okay, this is extremely inefficient, right? Especially in the days when these things were very costly, right? So obviously, it made sense to have end-to-end acknowledgements rather than at an every link you would have acknowledgements. Okay, so from a pure protocol standpoint, frame relay is obviously more efficient, right? Okay, and therefore, you can throw out XR25 and replace it with frame relay. And frame relay is more efficient economically compared to leased lines. Okay, so frame relay has been like a huge growing business, okay, for the last decade. It became very popular in the early to mid-90s and still has been skyrocketing after that. Okay, today people are trying to replace frame relay and ATM type circuits with MPLS or IP-based VPNs. Okay, but that transition is still occurring. It's not yet happened, but still frame relay sells very briskly. Okay, so again, to capture this, some of the differences are that we talked about the heavyweight, and XR25 is a layer 3 service, offers no quality of service capabilities. Frame relay does. Okay, frame relay also simplifies the link layer. Okay, in link layer, there's several functions, right? Frame relay breaks it into two parts. One is called LAPF core, and the other is called LAPF control. By the way, LAP is exactly the same as what we talked about in XR25. This F stands for frame, right? So you had LAPB there, and this is called LAPF. And LAPF itself, instead of having the whole junk, pile of junk, you break it up into two parts. Core means that you essentially optimize the headers into just what you want, and then you also have another piece called control, which is optional. Okay, so control, like essentially you want to do sort of get acknowledgements, etc., right? And you want to do congestion control and so on. So this is done only end to end. Okay, so we'll talk about that a little bit. Okay, there is also another service which basically died very soon called frame switching service. So frame relaying, remember, like if you do a relay race, you have to give me a frame and I'll take this and give it to the next game. It's basically forwarding, multi-hop forwarding, that's called relay. Frame switching means in addition to doing just the relay function or forwarding function, I also do some other fancy control functions. Okay, so that is called frame switching. Okay, and it died a quick death. Okay, so that so frame switching essentially implements both LAP core and this control at every hop, whereas a frame relay implements only LAP core at every hop, and LAPF is only implemented end to end. So another feature of frame relay is that instead of using heavyweight control messages along with the data, that is piggybacking control messages with the data, it uses a separate virtual circuit for control. Okay, so this is an example of a common control channel type of thing. Okay, it uses a separate virtual circuit for control channel, and this is differentiates it from the in-band control approach of XR25. So we didn't look at much of the control ideas in XR25, but essentially you saw there was a control field, right? That's like a heavily overloaded field. You try to do lots of control messages along with the data itself. You try to piggyback that. So frame relay just throws out all of that and has a separate control channel, which is used on as needed basis. Okay, so I also mentioned the idea that the pricing is probably why it really took off. And since it does not provide hop-by-hop error correction, it presumes that the underlying link layer, underlying physical layer, is fairly reliable. Okay, and that was true because fiber optics had already been deployed by that time. Okay, so this is again quick recap of some of the features. So some of the new things in frame relay are the quality of service capabilities, and there was a beautiful congestion control scheme that was added. Okay, now in terms of the congestion control features, they were completely ignored in frame relay. In the real world, they don't use it. Okay, but the features are really beautiful. But it also has made a reappearance in IP. Okay, this is again an idea which appears in telephone networks. It says come to IP. So it is called ECN. In IP, it's called explicit congestion notification. This is a bit-based, single bit-based feedback approach. There's a lot of interest in that today. But it came originally in a protocol called DECBIT, which was done by DEC. Actually, my advisor developed that scheme. And the same thing was pushed to frame relay. And it showed up in ATM, and also it is being pushed in IP. But it's not deployed. Okay, it's a very nice scheme, but it's not deployed out there. But the quality of service stuff is still there. Okay. So, as usual with every technology, you have its own specific language and lingo and all that. In terms of the boxes, essentially you saw the idea of a DTE or a data terminal equipment, which connects to a LAN, and it used to connect directly to a DCE on the communication side. So here you basically dump two more boxes here. One box is known as a CSU DSU. Okay. I'll talk what is this, and probably the more interesting box is called a FRAD or a frame relay access device. So frame relay access device does the end-to-end functions of frame relay, and CSU DSU is basically a telephony development. It's called data service unit and channel service unit. It's a way to just connect physically to the telephone network. Okay, it's a historical artifact. Okay, so frame relay access device is a generic name that multiplexes and formats traffic. You have an access line, and then when we talk about the traffic being bursty or burstiness, you're allowed to, essentially we talk about sporadic use of bandwidth. You're not active all the time. Suddenly you're inactive. And the committed information rate is perhaps one of the most beautiful ideas in frame relay, where on the packet channel you get a minimum bandwidth, and you pay on the basis of CIR. CIR is the basis on which pricing is done. Okay, and if your traffic is above CIR, packet, the bits are set, a bit called discard eligibility bit is set. Essentially, it says drop me. Okay, so it's very interesting. I mean, if you go above CIR, I still let you into the network, but I mark you as a lower priority packet through this DE bit. And if I indeed encounter congestion, that is my network happens to be under provisioned for whatever reason beyond this, then the network reserves the right to drop the bits marked DE. Okay, very simple idea. Usually these DE bits are packets still get through. Okay, lots of packets do get through because networks are usually over-provisioned. Okay, and then DLCI stands for Data Link Connection Identifier. All these huge terms are nothing but a label. Okay, DLCI is just the label. And there's a couple of congestion ideas. Essentially, this is a single bit-based congestion. If you recall, what you learned in CCN, in TCP, you have to actually drop a packet before you detect congestion. So packet loss is the congestion indicator. Okay, now packet loss is not a nice thing. I mean, if you drop a packet, not only detect congestion, you also detect packet loss, and you have to actually recover from the packet loss, right? So by having a single bit which indicates that I am congested, okay, you give the same information as what a packet loss would have given, except that you don't drop a packet. Okay, now this is very nice because you can then decouple congestion control, see the word decouple again, from the function of reliability. Even though you might use some similar mechanisms like window, rate, etc., you can decouple it functionally, okay, and you don't have to have effects which sort of cross-correlate. Okay, so these are the ideas which are introduced, and there are two varieties of this. One is known as backward, another is known as forward. We'll talk about it later. Okay, so I'm going to skip this stuff. So DLCI is nothing but the label, as I mentioned here. You have a label that can keep getting swapped. Okay, so as I mentioned again, it has local significance. That is the meaning of a label. Label is only local semantics. And you can have multiple logical connections or multiple virtual channels on top of a single access device. Okay, like you can buy a T1 line to reach your IXE, and then you can throw a lot of frame relay channels on top of it. Okay, so, and DLC0 is a special channel, which is the out-of-band signaling channel. And all signaling for all your channels, suppose I am, IBM Site 1 and there are IBM Site 2, 3, 4, I can use the same signaling channel to communicate with all these guys. Okay, I use the DLC channel called 0 to communicate with all the sites, but I have separate data channels for them. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, so UNI, remember, is called user network interface, right? Usually UNI is a combination of a user plane as well as control plane, or data plane and network plane. So if you look at it, on the control plane, you see this familiar number, Q.931. Which is that signaling protocol. Okay, obviously it was extended a little bit to have the frame relay features, and then it runs on top of its own data link protocol. It's an expanded, or you see this a little more fatter than the other protocol. So it has a slightly heavyweight link protocol. called LabD. Okay, now all this LabD, LabF are all descendants of HDLC. So LabF is a much more stripped down version in the data plane. Okay, and all of these have these peculiar numbers, so you can safely ignore them, and then you throw them on top of a physical link. Okay, so that is the basic structure here, which you need to understand. Okay, and in terms of the data or user plane, I think the interesting idea is that you have a stripped down link layer. Okay, and the link layer does multiplexing, frame delimiting, the usual things, right? It does the frame, flags and all that stuff. And then it does multiplexing and demultiplexing. Okay. Now, usually the circuit multiplexing and demultiplexing is done in the packet level or the layer 3 in X.25, but it is done at the frame level or layer 2 in frame relay. Okay. So error detection is provided, but not error correction. So it's important to know that error detection is much more fundamental functionality compared to error correction. We mentioned this. Okay. And this error correction normally means either FEC or more often ARQ procedures. ARQ is done only end-to-end. Okay, it is also another interesting feature that even though ARQ can be done end-to-end in frame relay, it is not done end-to-end. Okay, so in fact, if you look at the actual configuration in today's networks, I buy a frame relay line, and even though I can do an error correction across my frame relay link, that is my virtual circuit, people turn off that feature. Okay, that is the LAPF control feature that is turned off, because anyway, TCP does error correction end-to-end, right? So this is an example of frame relay being a very stripped down link layer. Okay, you can think of the entire virtual circuit as one link, one hop. Okay, it provides also congestion control features, again, which are safely ignored by most deployments. Even though these features are nice, they were turned off. Okay, and as I said, there was a frame switching variant which died. Okay, so this is how you want to think about frame relay. Frame relay has a very simple link layer and a very simple physical layer at the intermediate frame switches, the intermediate switches, and the end system has a control piece of the stack, but in practice all these major functions are disabled, so you can think of this as a null piece in the stack, but of course implementers have to implement it, right? And all these link layers looks very similar. Okay, you have a flag, which is the same thing. You have address. The only difference in the address is you put a DLCI into the address. Okay, so DLCI is nothing but label, and you have a couple of options. You can have either a 2-byte label or up to a 4-byte label. That's the only fancy thing. And then you have information, and you have a frame check sequence which can detect errors and drop the packets. That's all. Okay. So as I mentioned, the address can be either a 2-octet, 3-octet, or 4-octet. So you'll see these complex diagrams. You just completely ignore everything in the diagram and just note that you have multiple options for addressing. Okay, this is just to make you can use more efficient or less efficient type things. You have these fancy fields for FECN, BECN, and all that. Okay, and the DE, probably more important bit is DE. Okay, we'll study about DE because it's more important. All these other bits in practice are not used, but there's still a good theoretical curiosity. Okay, so as I said, the other beautiful aspect of frame relay is the traffic management. Okay, now in terms of what I mean by traffic management here is that the service model is not just best effort, it allows you to buy a minimum rate. Okay, that rate is called committed information rate, and it goes by the famous acronym CIR. Okay, and you're allowed to burst up to a peak rate. Usually this is the same as your access link bandwidth called PIR. Okay, but they could be different. You can buy a T1 line to reach your IX, your IXE, and then you can choose a different PIR, but in practice they're always the same. Okay, now this model is known as a CIR-PIR model. Okay, now this is often used in industry. Okay, so essentially what it means is that you are guaranteed CIR, but you can burst up to PIR. Okay, now all bets are off for those packets which have bursted beyond CIR. Okay, so but in practice they usually don't die, but they could die under congestion conditions. Okay, and the way you would enforce it, obviously you have to enforce it, right? So the way it is done is through the classic quality of service mechanisms. You have a policer at the edge, which makes sure that the packets which are under CIR have the discard eligibility bit 0. The packets which are above CIR but below PIR, the discard eligibility bit, DE bit, is set to 1. And the packets which are even more than PIR are dropped right there. Okay, those packets don't even cross the FRAD, the FRAD we saw, right? If you transmit even faster than PIR, those will be dropped. Okay? So that is the basic idea. So the network is usually over-provisioned to make sure that it can at least carry CIR. Okay, this is a guarantee, right? If you're guaranteeing, you better carry it. Okay, and then it's usually under-provisioned for sigma PIR. So this allows you, so this is a classic statistical multiplexing game. You have, you are allowed to, you must provision your network to be at least average rate. Okay, here this is a more of a guaranteed rate you, that can always happen. But you should, you can provision it below PIR, somewhere between this line. Okay, so, and it could drop packets with D during congestion. Okay, and it has some nice congestion control hooks, which is this bit. Okay, even we can see the power of a single bit is very useful. Okay. Okay, so the CIR, PIR, the way it works is as what I described, right? So suppose this time and this is the burst number of bits. Okay, so essentially what this means is suppose I send in almost zero time all the bits, right? I will see this curve like this. It will be standing up straight. If I transmit over time under CIR, this whole curve will be like this. So I have one packet sent here and then another packet sent here, etc. All overall this over time, right, over a time period, if I police this, this overall rate is less than CR. So in other words, the user is policing themselves. It's they are sending within the guaranteed rate. Now it is possible that you can send above CIR, okay, for a short period of time and still get away with it, but beyond a time, beyond a critical time, you cannot do that. Okay, so between CIR and access rate, okay, also called PIR, the discard eligibility bit could be set for a few packets. Okay, now once this happens, right, these bits, these are not really dropped at the edge, but may be dropped inside the core, but usually also not dropped in the core. Okay, now if you send even above the access rate, right, you can get dropped right there. Okay, or you suddenly send a huge burst of packets. You are not allowed to get in. So some of those packets will be dropped to the edge itself, okay, the FRAD device itself. So essentially, another way of looking at it is if your bits per second varies over time like this, some of these bits could be marked as discard eligible, and some of these could be dropped either at the edge or in the core. Okay, that's the basic idea. Very simple. Okay, so the policer which does that is the famous leaky bucket policer. Okay, so this exactly emulates what we wanted to do. So the name comes because you have a bucket of tokens. Okay, all these are virtual stuff. There's no real water standing at the FRAD. Okay, so there's a virtual bucket, and you have virtual tokens coming. All of this is like imaginary stuff. Okay, so there's a counter essentially. So if it's like a leaky bucket, right? So something should leak. So tokens leak out of it. In other words, when packets show up, you can ask the bucket, "Do you have a token?" And if so, it'll leak, and you pick up the token and walk in. So it's like getting a ticket, right? So Now, what will happen is that if the packets come too fast, it's obvious that you'll run out of tokens, right? And the tokens get replenished at a maximum rate of PIR. Okay, actually, the tokens get replenished on the average rate of CIR only. Okay, so you can hang on. Let me understand this. So up to peak rate, you can transmit. Okay, so the so you have a minimum committed rate and a peak rate, and you also have limits on how much you can burst on the short run. Okay, so you can have a bucket of bits bucket of tokens which you can consume suddenly and walk in. Okay, so you allow it some flexibility to burst, but not unbounded. It's a finite flexibility. So these parameters are captured by a couple of things called BE and BC. Okay, this committed burst and this excess burst. Okay, so there are this bunch of parameters. And the policing action is that if I am between BC and BC plus BE, you mark the DE bit. And if I am over this, you discard. Okay. Okay. So, and obviously the internal implementation is that if I am congested, I will have some kind of a threshold in my buffer. And if the threshold is crossed, I will start dropping packets that have the DE bit set. Okay. That is the idea. Anyway, so then the other congestion control cool idea which came in frame relay was called a Feckin and Becken. Okay, so Feckin, I mean, all this is just basically one bit. Okay, a big name for a bit. So you have one bit. Okay, and the core idea is again to decouple congestion control from reliability. If there is congestion, I will set the Feckin bit and ask and hope that the source will cut its rate. as I mentioned, in frame relay, usually the congestion control is disabled, so the source really does not cut its rate. Okay, so if the network becomes overwhelmed, it will just drop packets, and the end-to-end application, primarily TCP, will respond to it. Okay, but however, FECN has been specified as a standard. There is a method in which you can cut your rate. Okay, when you see a FECN bit, the source will do some statistics, or it'll average, it'll count how many FECN bits have been set over time, etc., and then it'll cut its rate depending upon that. So there's an algorithm here. The algorithm is not as important, but to realize that it's just an additive increase, multiplicative decrease style algorithm, it's the same as what is used in TCP, but the parameters are slightly different. Okay, so similarly, there's a variant called BECN. Okay, in FECN, what happens is when there's congestion, let me go here, the frame relay switch will set the bit in the forward direction, and the packet or the frame will actually go all the way to the destination, and then you will sort of reflect back that bit to the source. Okay. Whereas in BECN, the frame relay switch itself will generate a new frame called a BECN frame, or it actually is called a CLLM frame, and this will have a bit set here saying, I'm congested. Okay. Notice that if you have multiple frame relay switches, each of them can independently send beckons. Okay. Now, if you studied IP, you know that there's a protocol called ICMP, and it sometimes sends a message called congestion experienced message. Okay. So, and again, as it's classic, I mean, all these things are ignored. Okay. So, it was one of the legacy messages. And so, this is beckon is similar to that message, which is used in ICMP. So the tragedy is both of these things are ignored, but they are specified and they are implemented. Okay. So, and the nice thing about it, if you look at congestion control as a problem in detail, is that you can actually achieve nice congestion control properties with these things. Okay. Again, you have a window-based or rate-based control framework where you can increase your window additively, and then you can cut your rate when you start seeing bits. And you can do some statistics on the bits to see how many bits, and based upon that, you can cut your rate appropriately. Essentially, all you're doing is you're matching demand to supply. Okay, so with that, we end frame relay. To capture the key ideas, frame relay is much more lightweight, much more stripped down link layer, and it's called frame because it operates at layer 2, not layer 3. And the other interesting part of frame relay is that it offers a nice traffic management feature that is the CIR, PIR service model, which is implemented through standard leaky bucket, and you don't need any complex scheduler inside the core. Only one leaky bucket is enough. So it's a very, very lightweight implementation, and that's why whenever something is simple, it is cheap. And if something is cheap and it offers something valuable, it becomes popular, right? So like the CIR-PIR service was very valuable in relation to the prevailing T1 services. Okay, so frame relay is very valuable. Okay, and people thought that building upon the success of frame relay, let's build the next thing to frame relay, that is, let's go to higher speeds and let's all do video and everything. Okay, that was ATM. Okay, it turned out to be a big flop. So ATM is asynchronous transfer mode. That's what it stands for. So why ATM? Okay, now ATM is again another of those grand visions of the telephone companies. Said that, okay, now we had integrated services vision. Okay, now it turned out that integrated was not really integrated because it didn't integrate video. Okay, we saw that end-to-end, you can only do this, the speedly 128 kilobit per second is not good for video, right? So they wanted to be able to do video at least for enterprises, etc. So you needed a higher speed service, and ATM was to be that. Okay, and ATM also was developed around the same time as Sonnet and so on. So they thought both of those will go hand in hand. You can put Sonnet at the link layer, ATM at the network layer, and this whole stack roughly is called BISDN, or what this course is called, broadband ISDN, right? So broadband means high speed. And it's also integrated in the sense you can do video, voice, everything on it. And ATM will subsume frame relay because it operates pretty much like frame relay, but it can not only do data, it can not only do CIR, PIR, it can also offer other services, right? So it offers a bunch of services, some of which are similar to frame relay, some of which are similar to video services, some of which are similar to voice services. So all of them can be multiplexed on top of this packet switch framework. Okay, so in terms of what is its economic rationale, the telephone network, ATM was thought of as a way to replace the telephone network also. They wanted to take the T1s and all that and throw it out, use Sonnet at the lower layers, okay, and use ATM as the transport capability and map voice and video and data, everything. So if you go to a company like Verizon, which is a telephone company, right, I mean, chances are that you're going to see ATM equipment. I mean, as soon as you enter the central office, you'll see ATM boxes. Okay, what do? They take DSL lines or they take ISDN lines and then immediately convert them to ATM. And they also map phone calls on top of it. So for a phone company, it's an ideal solution because it's the thing which is guaranteed to carry voice as well as guaranteed to carry data and so on, right? So phone companies have not been very successful in offering video services, even though Bell South is trying to make some attempts to do that in the southern states. Anyway, so primarily it's been voice and data integration, though video option is available in ATM. Okay, so again, ATM was thought of like ISDN to go all the way to the end system, so you can have end-to-end ATM vision. Internet was at the time of ATM when it was developed, internet and Ethernet and even LAN technologies offered no quality of service. They were connectionless, they were packet switched, therefore it was all best effort service, no quality. Okay, and quality of service is always thought of as a major differentiator. Okay, the sort of cachet of quality of service has been dropping over time. Okay, and people don't care about quality of service really today. But over time, people have always been willing to pay for quality of service. Okay, but particularly if it's coupled with a compelling set of applications. Okay, so ATM networks are meant to provide all of the stuff. Okay, frame, and you see something is missing from every other technology, right? So frame relay and X.25, even though they're packet switched, don't provide QoS or don't provide sophisticated QoS, and they don't scale for high speeds. Whereas if you look at the telephone network, it provides QoS and everything great, but it's very costly, expensive, and so on, right? So ATM was thought to be this cheapo stuff. It turned out to be very expensive. Okay, so it was meant to support a range of service qualities at reasonable cost, and it was trying to use the beautiful techniques of statistical multiplexing and scheduling and all that to actually implement all on top of a single network. Okay, so I think again, the ideas in ATM are what are worth remembering. Okay, ideas by ideas we mean we should not repeat the mistakes. Okay, it's like history teaches us what not to repeat, right? So we should not repeat the mistakes of ATM, but again, at the same time, you should learn what was good in that. Like several IP heads typically forget about all these other technologies, they don't bother to learn it and continue to repeat some of the mistakes. I mean, not repeat some of the mistakes, they try to go on a diametrically opposite philosophy just for the sake of going in a diametrically opposite philosophy. So as research at RPI and elsewhere has shown, you can very profitably take ideas from these old technologies and adapt them for the new world. Okay, so even in very different contexts. Okay, so we'll study all this later in the class, but I think so you need to understand the philosophy here. So the thing which still remains is virtual circuits. You still have to nail down a path. Okay, obviously this nailing down of the path was thought of as a foregone conclusion because you needed quality of service. Okay, if you wanted to build a network which did not depend upon quality of service, you could give up this restriction. But virtual circuits were too useful just for that reason. And of course, it had this other auxiliary reason that packets overhead could be much smaller because you use labels. Okay, and then another feature of ATM, which was different from frame relay, was that it used fixed size cells. I mean, so, and it was also called cells rather than packets or frames. Cells is a layer 3 thing, but still it's not a frame, right? So the cells are fixed size. And fixed size was thought of as a very important feature because it turned out that at the time when switching boxes were being developed or high-speed packet switching boxes were being developed, it was much more easier to engineer fixed size, switches with fixed size cells, okay, rather than with variable size packet. Okay, now we'll study this issue again much more carefully when we study switching in detail. Okay, in fact, that is going to be the next major topic after we finish all this architectural survey. Switching, high-speed routing, what are the issues in that? And we'll see that like TDM switching, fixed size switches are very similar to TDM switches. They just have a few attributes which are different. But even today, in high speed IP switch, IP routers, the core, internal to the core, right, they'll take a variable size IP packet and then chop it into fixed size cells and actually do the switching in fixed size. Okay, so variable size switching, even though it has been developed as a technology, is still yet to take over the world. So fixed-size switching was a major leap at that time because it was possible when you go to high-speed networks, okay, when you say the whole network is high-speed, what does it mean? It means the links are high-speed thanks to fiber optics on it and the framing technologies and so on, okay, and also DWDM. But it also means that the switches have to be fast, right? The core of the switches have to be really fast. The switching fabric has to be fast. So switching fabrics were developed for high speed, and fixed size was a big deal at that time. And also fixed size meant that you wouldn't have variance. Okay, if I stand in a queue where there are different sized packets, okay, you know, a standard example of this is like operating system job scheduling, where you have different processes which are standing, and each of them uses a different amount of time. So you'll stand in variable amount of time in the queue. And if you do standard queuing analysis, if you look at DD1 queuing analysis and so on, fixed size means that there's no randomness in the size of the queue, elements of the queue. Okay, so randomness is what causes delay. Randomness is what causes it. In fact, if you study a DD1 queuing system, which we do in CCN, the first thing you learn is that delay is almost zero. Okay, it's a very fundamental fact. If you take an MM1 queuing system, you have a Poisson arrival, and all this Poisson business is irrelevant. It's only it's random arrivals and then random service times. Okay, the randomness occurs not because it's generally random, it's because the packet sizes are random. Service times are random because of that. So if I have randomness, just the randomness itself causes delay, because you don't know how much to keep. Right? Suddenly you'll have bursts. Randomness means you'll have bursts and so on. So that's what caused delay. Whereas fixed size means that usually if I have an input and a fixed service rate, the delay, if you don't overload the system, right, even if you load it to 90-95%, okay, input rate is almost 95% of the output rate, delay will be zero. There will be just one packet in the queue. And if that packet is made small, the delay is almost nothing, right? So the delay and delay jitter as experienced in a single queue, both on the average and in terms of high-speed variations, is very small. So fixed size and small was thought of as a very, very important attribute in ATM. Okay, in fact, the book also talks about this in much more detail. You should read the book. So, but it turned out that ATM had to choose how small is small, right, or how big is big. So they had to make a compromise. Okay, and probably the most laughed about thing in ATM is that they made a stupid decision about how small they wanted to go. Okay, so obviously if they had made a cell size of about 128 bytes, something like that, I mean, even that wouldn't have been a big deal. But they made the packet size very small, like 48 bytes. Okay, and on top of that, they add a 5-byte header, which made the overall efficiency somewhat smaller, but that's not a major issue. Anyway, so the fixed size and small had a clear rationale, both in terms of being able to reduce the overall variance of service, from a statistical multiplexing standpoint, as well as to build high-speed switches. Okay, so these were very important ATM concepts, but they botched it in terms of what is the size they chose. Okay, and a very funny story, but we'll talk about that. And statistical multiplexing, we said, is just the capability to size your switches and your capacity, etc., so that it can, you can be larger than average demand, right? So more importantly, what we mean by statistical multiplexing in an ATM context is that we can use, we can actually have data of or a fixed rate service like a CBR stream, a variable rate service, and another type of service called unspecified bit rate, which is data services. All of this, we can multiplex it, and not only can you multiplex it, we can multiplex it statistically because we use packet switching. So statistical multiplexing is actually a loaded term when it refers to ATM, because it also refers to complex scheduling behavior, which can be used to extract as much gain as possible and making as little reservations as possible, and therefore getting the biggest bang for the buck for your switches as well as links. Okay, obviously, all this means the switch is costly and link is costly, which was true in the telephone days. I mean, if you buy a telephone switch, it's still millions and millions of dollars. Whereas if you buy a data switch or a Ethernet switch, right, you can go and buy an Ethernet switch from Dell, which switches at a multiple 24 gigabit Ethernet ports and still costs $2,000. Okay, so data switches fundamentally are cheap and to some degree, unreliable compared to other switches. I mean, the reliability game has been played out. Manufacturing has got so great that reliability is much, much higher nowadays. But usually the reliability is not because of the hardware. Usually software is filled with bugs, and then you have signaling and other things. You have protocol unreliabilities which creep into routers. Anyway, so we talked about statistical multiplexing, which is sort of gains in terms of switching costs and link costs, and integrated services, being able to integrate multiple services. And as in all telephone stuff, you have great traffic management and engineering features. Okay, and more important, just like Sonnet, the whole thing could scale in terms of speed a network size. So obviously, I mean, if you were a telephone head at that time, you'd think this is the greatest thing after since sliced bread, right? So it can carry all these multiple type of servers, and then we can dominate the world and collect rents. Okay, obviously, something went wrong. So what went wrong? People tried to push ATM all the way till the end system, okay? And the customers protested. They wouldn't. I mean, for example, I remember the time when I came here to RPI, there was a big debate about whether we should upgrade the campus backbone to ATM. Okay, and the system administrator was completely against it. Okay, so because they didn't want to learn a new protocol, they didn't want this like a heavyweight protocol and it's costly, etc., etc. And they were right. And what happened was Ethernet became faster and faster. The old FDDI core ring, which was at RPI, was thrown out, and now we have gigabit Ethernet available in campus, right? So, and then later it'll be replaced by 10 gigabit Ethernet and so on. So ATM did not succeed in the LAN, but as we shall see, the technology by itself was developed to make a high-speed LAN technology. When it was developed, fast Ethernet just appeared late in the game. Okay, Ethernet was only the LAN technology, and FDDI was another LAN technology operating at 100 megabits. But there was nothing which could guarantee quality of service, nothing which could operate at 155 or higher speeds. ATM promised to be that. I give you high speed, I also give you quality of service. You can do lots of things with your LAN. By the way, it's heavy management, it's a heavy protocol, you have to pay a lot of money, that's a separate issue. But what happened is, magically, fast Ethernet appeared and it decimated ATM, okay, so in the LAN. So the failed market test is, since it died in the LAN, the whole concept of end-to-end ATM all the way to your desktop also died, right? So that was one major issue with ATM. But then, today, ATM is still a thriving business. If you see Lucent's sales, half of its sales is still ATM. Okay, so ATM is still being deployed by telephone companies as their frame relay backbones, or even internet backbones. IP has been mapped to ATM and so on. Okay, and if you look at central offices, all your broadband lines from the central office are aggregated into ATM by these guys. So carriers use a lot of ATM. Okay, so ATM stands for asynchronous transfer mode. Okay, so then one should ask, what is synchronous? Why is it asynchronous, right? So synchronous is what we studied in SONET, right? So SONET was synchronous in the sense that the frame was delimited by time, not by bits. Okay, so time was the essential delimiter. Whereas in ATM, it is not time which is a frame, but it's a packet or a cell. Okay, packet, the number of bits in a packet are fixed. The time is not fixed. Okay, so ATM cells are defined in terms of packets, not in terms of time. Okay, now the other aspect of ATM, besides the time frame, is that the cells can show up at any point of time. Okay, so that is why they are asynchronous. Synchronous means they have to show up exactly at every 125 microsecond thing. Okay, so sometimes at the first 125 microsecond, you might see an ATM cell. Next, you might not see, and so on and so forth. So that's another aspect of asynchronous. Okay, so those are the two meanings of asynchronous. And as I said, asynchronous also implies that you're using a packet switching rather than a circuit switching TDM mode. And another aspect of asynchronous means that in phone networks, you get these rigid multiples of 64 kilobits per second, whereas in ATM, you can get any rate. Okay, and this is, again, another flexibility of a packet-based network. And another aspect of ATM is that even though the SONET and everything provides a lot of flexibility to set up and provision SONET channels, today, if you want to provision a T1 line across the country, it still takes a long time. So there's a huge provisioning lead time. Whereas in ATM, it allows you to switch or set up a quick switch virtual circuit. So physical circuits like T carrier lines take a long time to provision, whereas virtual circuits of any type, whether it's frame relay or ATM, can be dialed up quickly. Okay, so ATM allows dialing at any speed. Okay, it turns out that in practice, you cannot dial really very fast, or you can't. So dial means what? You can dial up bandwidth. I want bandwidth. Give me a circuit, right? And then now I start transmitting. So those types of virtual circuits are known as switched virtual circuits, or SVCs. Even though they have been defined in standards, in practice, provisioning timescales for circuits are still large. Okay, but theoretically, you can do rapid provisioning. Excuse me. Okay, so a quick recap of how ATM is different from data networks, primarily the internet. Both of this is data network only, but the internet is the canonical example. Internet does not use virtual circuit. We described this earlier. It's connectionless. It does not pin the path. It does not set up connections. Oh, by the way, a recent development in the last 5 years has been, there's been one signaling protocol developed for the internet. Okay, it can be optionally used. And that protocol is called RSVP. There's also another incarnation of RSVP called LDP. Okay, we'll study these things in when we study MPLS. Okay, so ATM cells. Oh, by the way, one key point about, even though RSVP is a signaling protocol, it is what is known as a decoupled signaling protocol. I mean, the word decouple, again, what it means is that the signaling protocol is decoupled from routing. In ATM, signaling is coupled with routing. That is, when the call shows up, it has to invoke a routing protocol to find a path for it, and signaling just goes along with the routing protocol and reserves resources or nails down the path. Whereas in RSVP, it is decoupled by, I mean, more is forced rather than actually, you cannot, even if you wanted to couple, you couldn't couple, because internet routing protocols had already been deployed. You had BGP, OSPF, all of them are already in place. And now you want to introduce a signaling protocol. There's no way you can couple it to the existing routing protocols. So what will happen in RSVP is that it will use whatever route is already there. You cannot separately manage that route. Okay, so RSVP was decoupled. Okay, so that's the idea of RSVP. I'll study it later. Now, ATM, another aspect is that it has this fixed and small cell size. And the routing, by the way, in ATM, is not only is it coupled, it's also very complex. Okay, in fact, there was a lot of strides in quality of service routing, quality of service building blocks, and traffic management architecture during the ATM days. So, in fact, PNNI, which stands for ATM's underlying routing protocol, which assists in signaling, is a remarkable protocol. I mean, it has beautiful features. It's extremely scalable. It supports lots of features. It can support voice, it can support data. I mean, it's extremely stable also. I mean, no software bugs. I mean, even though it's fairly complex, okay. So, specified down to the bit, okay, or very well specified protocols, etc. Okay, but still, it's complex, okay, it's big, and all this functionality is not necessarily needed. Whereas, if you can contrast it, internet provides best effort routing, okay. So, it's just like routing which runs in the background, and it will set up a single path for you. You can take whatever path is available. Whereas, in PNNI, you can actually choose your path according to specified characteristics, quality of service characteristics. So, this kind of routing is sometimes also called source routing or source-based routing, okay. So, the other aspect of addressing we've already seen before, this is the same as X.25 and so on. ATM uses huge 20-byte addresses for signaling, and then it uses local labels for the actual data transmission. Whereas IP uses 32-bit global addresses or globally some meaningful addresses in all packets. So, every packet is on its own, right? So, when it shows up at a router, it should have an address with global semantics. If this address is meaningless globally, then the packet will be dropped. And of course, it provides very sophisticated traffic management, which is unmatched even by IP today. So, I mean, so from a pure theoretical interest point of view, ATM had marvelous features. Okay, it was one of the, it made some of the biggest strides in terms of quality of service, in terms of traffic engineering, which IP is still learning how to take it. Okay, but IP has other challenges. ATM was designed in a day where there are only a few big players, as I mentioned, right? It's one big telephone company, and I want to try to provide quality of service across this. That's a far cry from today's internet, where you have lots of bit players, and you want to try to provide quality of service over them. Okay, but still, there are mechanisms available, and we have developed some of them at RPI. Okay, so the brief history of ATM is that it primarily happened from the mid-80s through the 90s. Okay, again, if you remember that AT&T was broken up in 1984, and it was triggered after SONET. Okay, in fact, after SONET was adopted roughly in 1986, people decided, okay, we want to also have a convergence layer at the network layer. So then this vision of BISDN was formed. And another sort of untold secret is that ISDN died around the same time. And so the next thing was BISDN. Okay, and the momentous decision to come up with a 53-byte cell, probably the biggest mistake, was made in 1989. Mm. Okay, and when I went to undergrad. Okay, and then, so I've participated personally in lots of ATM forum activities. Okay, it's a very wonderful, very interesting activity to participate in standards. So, well, 1996, it died in the enterprise. but rollouts really picked up around this time in carrier networks. So it still exists today, and it's working out in carrier networks, but its future is much less certain. Okay, so how are you doing on time? We have time. Okay, so ATM has a lot more interfaces than other things because it provides for a variety of interconnections. Okay, but it still is not very general purpose in the sense that ATM recognized the fact that the Bell system was broken up. You have some local exchange carriers, you have inter-exchange carriers, but that's about it. It did not anticipate the internet world where there will be lots of autonomous systems, like 12,000 autonomous systems. No. Okay, so it specified only a few interfaces, and these interfaces are enormously complex, okay, huge complexity. Okay, even though the basic idea of data plane was very simple, because they wanted to have all kinds of options in signaling, it became enormously complex. So these interfaces are known as UNI, user to network interfaces. There are two varieties of it. It's called private UNI and public UNI. Private UNI is to basically the end-to-end ATM philosophy. Your computer implements ATM, you get an ATM card. I mean, I have experience of actually playing around with ATM cards for the computer. And that implements private UNI. It'll go to switches, ATM switches or LAN switches. And your edge of your network, like the FRAD devices, you would have ATM's edge devices, which will implement public UNI. And there are other protocols called private NNI, that is switch-to-switch protocols. NNI stands for network node interface. Okay, it's basically switch-to-switch. Public and private. Private means within an enterprise. Public means if you want to talk to Verizon or if you want to talk to AT&T, okay, which is a public provider or carrier. Okay, so that is the idea. And between carriers, suppose I want to go from Verizon to AT&T, that interface was sometimes called a BICI. Okay, we will not study all this stuff in much detail. And then there was another sort of direct router to switch type interface, or you can actually connect a router directly to ATM through a special interface called DXI. Okay, so we'll basically ignore much of this. We'll study PNNI and all these, which are specific cases of NNI. Okay, and we'll study traffic management, which are specific cases of UNI. Okay. Okay, so there's lots of standards. Okay, and we'll religiously ignore most of it. Okay, so the idea again, just like most of the networks, is you have lots of switches or these forwarding and filtering engines here, and some of them are enterprise side, okay, and you also have work group switches. These are all just marketing terms, which means that it's a cheaper switch, it has lesser capacity, and these, there are bigger switches, backbone switches, and then there are high speed, huge switches which can do a lot of aggregation and other complex functions, which are in the carrier networks. So this is the switch hierarchy. Okay, and then like every other protocol, we look at layers. Okay, so then so at the highest layer of ATM is known as an adaptation layer. Okay, so this is a layer which dresses up higher level protocols, puts on clothes so that the packets can come and become ATM cells. Okay, so real packets from IP, etc., are mapped to AAL, and AAL then adapts it so that you can transmitted as cells. Okay, so ATM basically provides some raw functions, and you have some value-added capabilities here. There are two AAL layers which are really famous, and we'll talk about that. And internally, the switches are very simple; they just do ATM stuff. But the complexity is primarily in the control plane and management plane. The data plane of ATM is perhaps one of the most beautifully designed, albeit for a few mistakes. Nice, very well designed data plane. Control plane is a different story. Okay, so every layer also has sometimes it's broken up into sub-layers. Okay, now we will again ignore this division of functionality between sub-layers and then so on. But just it's useful to know that there's something known as sub-layer. Okay, so if I look at at AAL, right, it stands for adaptation layer. So essentially what happens in AAL is I take a packet like PPP packet. Okay, so this looks like a PPP packet, right? You have the payload and control length and CRC and all this stuff. And then I want to break it up into cells. Okay, and while doing this breakup, I have to tell you where the packet begins and where the packet ends. Okay, how many cells belong to one packet. So this is done using the more bit. Okay, so this is a classic example of AAL5. Okay, so most data traffic is mapped to AAL5, which is a convergence layer for data. And IP packets show up as a frame here, and then it is chopped up into cells and then sent. Okay. So this function of chopping up packets into cells is sometimes known as segmentation, or you've learned in IP it's called fragmentation, right? It's the same thing. Only difference is that in ATM, packets are guaranteed to go on the same path, cells are guaranteed to go on the same path, and they are supposed to be in order. So you'll never get an out of order cell. There's no such thing as an out of order cell. So you can use the more bit. Okay, so that is the, so you have very simple fragmentation and reassembly procedure. Okay, I'm going to skip this. Okay, so there are a few types of AALs, okay, and AAL1 is a famous AAL. It is popular because it maps voice or CBR traffic, voice to CBR, that's what it does. It takes voice channels like T1 lines and so on, and then maps it to CBR, which is a form of service, it's one of the ATM service classes. Then these other two things died, and then AAL5 showed up, and this is used to transport data like IP traffic and so on top of ATM. Okay, so that's the thing. Okay, we are just going to ignore all the frame structure and all. There's nothing fancy about it. I just want to put it there. All of them have the standard error check to see if the whole thing is an error, and it'll just drop the packet. And then they have a bunch of things which are safely ignored. Okay, so one of the take-home messages in ATM is, even though a lot of villainy is attributed to telephone providers of trying to dominate the world, they did try to internetwork with almost all any possible link layer and any possible network layer. So you see that ATM can be mapped on top of almost any link, okay, whether it's fiber or copper, unshielded twisted patch, shielded twisted patch. They learned their lessons from Ethernet. They knew that Ethernet killed token ring because it was focused, it tied the appropriate physical layer with the link layer, right? So that's what. So ATM decided not to make that mistake. Okay, it made other mistakes. It did not know, right? That's why the world is interesting. Okay, so it made, the take-home message was that there was a very serious attempt to internetwork. For example, you can map ATM to Sonnet. So remember we talked about this POH, TOH and all these nice things. And you had the Sonnet frame which is a time frame. The payload or the synchronous payload envelope can float in this across the Sonnet frames, right? STS frames. So ATM would be basically hanging out here. So all these yellow fellows are ATM. So you put a cell and then you might have no bits, and then another cell will show up. So essentially in Sonnet, if I want to pick up an ATM cell, I need some way to know that this fellow is an ATM cell, right? So there is a framing bit, and there is a fancy procedure in ATM header called HEC or header error correction. It also has a dual framing function. That is, if I just look at the HEC, I can also sort of synchronize with the fact that, oh, by the way, there's an ATM cell also. Okay, so there is a framing aspect of ATM. Since it can appear arbitrarily in the Sonnet payload, you can actually pick out it by a fancy procedure. We're not going to get into that procedure, but there have been a lot of these such cute tricks which have been done to avoid bits in ATM. Remember, ATM is already 48 bits. You don't want to add like huge framing bits and so on. Okay, if you look at most of the ATM header, it is just composed of virtual circuit identifiers. Okay, remember the virtual circuit itself is four bytes, right? So there's 32 bits. So there's a lot of, almost the entire thing is just a virtual circuit identifier. There's 5 bytes of header and 4 bytes of it is VC or a virtual circuit identifier. So then what, 1 byte, how can you put a framing byte, right? So there's a lot of other functions as well, right? So framing is done through a cute trick in ATM. Okay, so, but they are basically mapped asynchronously on top of Sonnet. This is why it got its name A, okay, ATM. Okay, another nice concept of ATM, which is not unique to ATM, it was also done by frame relay as well, is this notion of trunking. Okay, so just like we studied the notion of taking a phone call, digitizing it, and then developing a hierarchy like T1 to T3 and so on, you can take a small virtual circuit and put in a larger virtual circuit and so on, right? So, but the key difference is these virtual circuits are packets and they are also virtual, right? They are packet-based circuits. Well, those are TDM or time-based circuits. So ATM developed a hierarchy where you can define a virtual path and a virtual channel. The virtual path is more permanent and channels can be switched, or in other words, called upon demand. Okay? So VCs are a way to dial up and get bandwidth.